Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Scott Ritter, a former chief UN weapons inspector in Iraq from 1991 through 1998, who assesses the political fallout triggered by the recognition that President Bush was wrong in his assertion that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. Kathy Hoyt, co-coordinator of the Nicaraguan Network, who talks about the plight of Nicaraguan banana workers suffering adverse effects from toxic pesticides and a $17 billion lawsuit filed against them by multinational fruit and chemical companies. And Charles Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity, who discusses his book, The Buying of the President 2004, who's really bankrolling Bush and his Democratic challengers and what they can expect in return. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In recent weeks, cooperation between the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague and the Serbian government has collapsed. War crimes prosecutors say 15 fugitives, including Radovan Karadzic and General Ratko Mladic, who was charged with genocide in the mass murder at Srebrenica, Bosnia, now reside in Serbia. Carla Del Ponte, the chief prosecutor in the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal, told the Guardian newspaper, "Belgrade is now a safe haven for our fugitives. Karadzic is now residing in Belgrade." In January, NATO troops raided a house near Sarajevo in an attempt to capture Karadzic, who has been a fugitive for 8 years. The Serbian Interior Ministry says they have no information to back up Del Ponte's allegations. Meanwhile, radical Serbian nationalists have made gains in recent elections. A leading critic of the War Crimes Tribunal, Vojislav Kostunica, is the leading candidate to become Serbia's next prime minister and has made moves to include Slobodan Milosevic's Socialist Party in a new government. Milosevic remains on trial for war crimes in The Hague. The mandate for the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal expires in 2004, and there is growing international pressure to capture Karadzic and General Mladic. Del Ponte claims they could be easily arrested if the Serb authorities cooperated. The town leaders of Carlsbad, New Mexico, put out the red carpet for officials in the U.S. Department of Energy in 2002. The aim was to win the $4 billion contract to build a new nuclear bomb-making factory that will supply a new generation of plutonium pits, or triggers in nuclear weapons. The community is already home to a major underground nuclear waste dump, so Carlsbad Mayor Bob Forrest and civil leaders are eager to host the new bomb-making plant. The DOE is set to pick a site for the bomb factory this spring, and Carlsbad is competing against other towns, including the home of South Carolina's Savannah River nuclear weapons plant. Still, arms control experts oppose the new plant, which will be the biggest expansion of the nuclear weapons complex in 40 years. According to Mother Jones magazine, the new bomb factory will in effect replace the Rocky Flats plant and will have the capacity to make 450 plutonium pits a year, something that California U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein claims exceeds the entire current arsenal of China. Critics charge that the plan to build large numbers of new nuclear triggers would violate the 1970 Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. The African nation of Nigeria, itself notorious for corruption, is investigating if the Halliburton Company, under Vice President Dick Cheney's watch during the late 1990s, paid a $180 million bribe to win a natural gas contract. According to the French press agency AFP, the alleged bribe was offered by Halliburton's Kellogg, Brown & Root division, which at the time was a partner in an international consortium seeking to build a $4 billion natural gas plant in Nigeria. A French judge is in the midst of a full-scale investigation of the corruption charge, and the U.S. Justice Department announced in February that it had opened its own probe into the alleged bribe. In recent weeks, charges were filed in Nigeria against several former high-level government officials for allegedly accepting kickbacks from a French electronics firm in exchange for a $214 million contract to supply ID cards. For months, Halliburton has been under fire for overcharging the U.S. government for the price of fuel in Iraq. Company executives have also admitted to paying bribes to win food service contracts. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
After grudgingly accepting the evidence that no weapons of mass destruction will likely ever be found in Iraq, the White House has been engaged in damage control, countering critics, including presidential candidates vying for the Democratic Party nomination, who are pounding President Bush on his credibility gap. Although David Kaye, the former chief U.S. weapons inspector in Iraq, declared that Saddam Hussein's government probably had no weapons of mass destruction at the time of the U.S. invasion, he blamed a failure of intelligence rather than the White House. But soon after CIA Director George Tenet stated publicly that his agency never told President Bush that Iraq posed an imminent threat to the U.S., another key player in the pre-war drama, former U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq Hans Blix, has also pointed fingers. He recently compared President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair to insincere salesmen exaggerating the importance of the evidence of weapons of mass destruction they used to promote their attack on Iraq. One of the few officials with a working knowledge of Iraq's weapons systems to publicly oppose the Bush administration's march to war was Scott Ritter, a former Marine intelligence officer who served as a chief UN weapons inspector in Iraq from 1991 through 1998. In the years before the war, Ritter challenged the president's assertion that Baghdad's weapon system posed a grave risk to the U.S. and necessitated a war. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Scott Ritter about the Capitol Hill blame game and his view of the commission appointed by Mr. Bush to investigate U.S. intelligence failures.
What we're looking at here is a very delicate political ballet taking place. We have three players, I guess we should say four players involved. We have David Kaye. If anybody for a second feels that David Kaye's statements are that of an independent, objective observer of the process, then they're mistaken in the extreme. David Kaye was handpicked. He's an ideologue. He's not a technical expert. He's an ideologue. He was handpicked by the Bush administration to do a job in Iraq that had nothing to do with searching for the truth and had everything to do with spinning facts to the political benefit of the Bush administration. This is why David Kaye for some time now has been saying that he was going to find weapons, that there were weapons. And then finally in December of 2003, he had to come clean and say not only were there no weapons, but you weren't going to find any weapons. And now he opens up and he passes on the baton to the next player. He says, don't blame the president, blame the intelligence community. Enter George Tenet. Now, George Tenet, the director of the CIA, says, don't blame us. We never said that there was an imminent threat, that this is a case of policymakers coming to extreme conclusions based upon, you know, the intelligence data we did provide. Now, note there was no angry backlash from the White House on either what David Kaye said or what George Tenet said. In fact, the president invited David Kaye to a lunch, and the president said George Tenet's job is secure. He has nothing to fear. The president organizes a commission to investigate the intelligence failures, keeps it away from policy decision-making issues, and then says, I'm going to give them the time they need to reach a conclusion, meaning 2005, after the fall 2004 presidential election. The president succeeded in taking a very delicate issue, allowing the perception of criticism to occur, and then packaging it up and processing it in a manner in which whatever conclusion is reached, if one is ever reached, won't come out until after, you know, the period of vulnerability for the president, that is the elections of November 2004. This is a political charade that's being perpetrated before the American public.
Scott Ritter, there are many prominent Democrats, among them some who are running for president, who voted for the war resolution and are a little vulnerable on this issue. Do you think that the Democratic Party will call the president's bluff and publicly state that this commission appointed by the president to look into these intelligence failures is not credible? Or is the American public going to be stuck with what you're describing as pretty much a sham?
No, I don't believe that there's anybody in the Democratic Party right now who has the courage to call the president's bluff, because they are almost all universally culpable in this war. John Kerry, so far the leading candidate for the nomination, is somebody who had ample opportunity in the build-up to this war to debate the issue of the threat posed by Iraq, etc. Instead of having an honest debate, John Kerry went through the process of a sham hearing, using the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee to bring in handpicked witnesses that did nothing more than sustain, you know, a foregone conclusion that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and represented a threat to the United States worthy of military intervention. John Kerry did this because in 2002, John Kerry knew that he was going to run for president, and he wasn't going to get himself involved on the wrong side of a political argument. He made what he deemed to be the politically correct choices. Tragically, the men and women of the U.S. Armed Forces are the ones who are paying a blood price for the politically correct choice of John Kerry and the other Democrats who didn't have the courage to stand up to the president in 2002.
What advice do you have for all of us as citizens and what we can do to restore credibility and extricate our country from what some people are calling a quagmire or a sand trap?
There will be no elegant solution. We are not going to come out of this smelling good. This is going to hurt. Now, what we need to do is remember where our loyalties lie. And our loyalties lie with the men and women who wear the uniform of the United States Armed Forces. And the question every American should be asking themselves is, how big do they want the war memorial to be? How many American names do they want carved into whatever memorial will eventually be produced from the war in Iraq? We are not going to win this war. This war is already lost. So my solution is to get our troops out now. Our presence in Iraq is not a constructive presence. If you, to use an analogy, view Iraq as a nation on fire from top to bottom, from east to west. The fuel that feeds this fire is the presence of American troops. In order to put the fire out, you have to remove the fuel. Get the boys and girls home now. Do what we can with the international community to try and achieve some sort of stability. But the bottom line is, Iraq is going to have to sort this problem out without a unilateral American occupation.
That was Scott Ritter, a former Marine intelligence officer and United Nations weapons inspector. His book, Frontier Justice, Weapons of Mass Destruction and the Bushwhacking of America, is published by Context Books. As many as 20,000 banana workers and their families in Nicaragua are suffering serious health problems, including sterility and birth defects, from the use of a pesticide, Nemagon, that was banned for use in the U.S. in 1979. 500 banana workers filed a lawsuit in Nicaraguan courts that won a $500 million judgment against U.S.-based companies Dole, Dow, and Shell, but the companies refused to recognize the judgment. They attacked the Nicaraguan law that was passed to allow the affected banana workers to sue the chemical and fruit companies. Dole, in particular, claims it is environmentally and socially responsible on its banana plantations. The three companies recently countersued the claimants for fraud, claiming not everyone included in the suit worked on the banana plantations. The companies are seeking $17 billion in damages. Last week, thousands of banana workers and their supporters marched from Chinandega in the north of Nicaragua to Managua, the capital, to publicize their plight and to demand support from the government of President Enrique Bolaños. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Kathy Hoyt, co-coordinator of the Nicaragua Network, a solidarity organization that is supporting the demands of the banana workers for justice in the case. She talks about the difficulties the workers face and their campaign to enlist the support of both the U.S. and Nicaraguan governments to influence a settlement with the companies.
The pesticide was banned for use in the United States in 1979 when it turned out that many of the employees in the factory where the pesticide was being produced were becoming sterile. It was also thought to be, and there were tests done on that, a cancer-causing agent. But it continued to be used in Nicaragua up until 85. There are at least about 20,000 people alive now who were possibly affected by that pesticide, and several thousand of them have presented their claims in legal cases. The companies have refused to pay or even to recognize the judgment. The latest was that they have filed countersuits against the workers and their organizations, including one, the workers who have brought other cases against them for filing false reports and inflating the numbers of workers damaged by the pesticide.
And when did they file those countersuits?
Evidently, in December, Dole filed under RICO, which is the law that in the United States is used to prosecute mafia elements. Then Dow and Shell have also filed suit, but they're not evidently using RICO. So the Nicaraguan banana workers, with this march to Managua, about 4,000 of them have marched to Managua, and they are demanding that their government support them in fighting this suit And they also stopped by the U.S. Embassy to leave off a letter for U.S. Ambassador Barbara Moore asking her to pressure the companies to drop the suit and to negotiate with the banana workers.
I know that they had certain demands, one of which was that the president, Bolaños, declare that the situation of the banana workers is a national emergency. Can you just say if there's any other demands when the workers meet with President Bolaños, what else they're asking for?
They're asking that the president try to bring a legal representative of Shell and Dole to Nicaragua to talk with the workers, to make those accusations right there in Nicaragua. And they'd also like a pension fund to support those affected by Nemagon during the litigation process. They're hoping that they will eventually get compensation. The National Assembly also has insisted in the past that they would support the law that they passed to allow the workers to sue. It was a law specifically passed for the banana workers to sue. There was also pressure put in the CAFTA negotiations of the chemical companies wanted the Central America Free Trade Agreement that was recently signed by trade representatives from the United States and Central American countries. The chemical companies wanted that trade agreement to include a prohibition of these kinds of suits for responsibility for use of chemicals in the different countries. It appears that is not a part of the agreement. People are still trying to, the text has now been made public, and people are trying to decipher it, but it appears that they were not successful in getting that measure. But you can see that it is important to the chemical and fruit companies to be able to put those powerful chemicals on the food that we eat in order to make it look pretty, even though it damages the health of the workers.
Now, one thing, you said that it was banned in the U.S., I think, in 1979.
Mm-hmm,
it continued to be used in Nicaragua until 1985.
Yes.
So it's not being used now.
No, but there's always the suspicion, and we hear this again and again, that there could be something similar being used on the bananas, and we don't know what the effects of that are likely to be, because the bananas are still pretty.
Right.
So we don't know, and nobody really trusts the companies to tell them what the, you know, the safety issues are.
So the people, the banana workers who have gotten ill or their family members who have gotten sick, it's either from the fact that they worked back before 1985 when Nemagon was used, or there's something else currently being used to make them sick.
Or alternatively, the pesticide does live on in the soil and the groundwater and things like that. So there could be continuous damage. And then once, of course, much of the damage is, for example, sterility and low sperm count. So there are many banana workers, many men, are sterile. Their capacity to have children will never be restored to them. And many people feel, of course, that that is deserving of a rather substantial compensation. And then for the families, for the women who were affected, have had numerous miscarriages and many children with birth defects.
That was Kathy Hoyt of the Nicaragua Network. For information on how to contact Dole, Dow, and Shell and the U.S. Ambassador to Nicaragua, call the network at area code 202-544-9355 or visit the group's website at www.nicanet.org. On in this year's race for the White House, President Bush and his Democratic opponents, Senator John Kerry and former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, declined federal matching funds and spending limits for their primary campaigns, signaling what may be the nation's most costly presidential campaign ever. Although the United States Supreme Court recently upheld key provisions of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform legislation banning soft money, the new law will have little effect in reining in profligate spending by big corporations and special interest groups. Already, President Bush has amassed more than $130 million for his re-election bid. The bankrupt and discredited Enron Company is Mr. Bush's top career patron, having contributed more than $600,000 to his various campaigns. Other industries backing the president include the nation's top financial investment firms, such as Merrill Lynch, and big credit card companies like MBNA. The Democratic Party's likely candidate, U.S. Senator John Kerry, lists personal assets between $200 and $800 million, primarily through his wife's wealth. During his political career, Kerry has received critical support from media giant Time Warner, big banks, and powerful law firms. The public, exposed to a succession of major financial scandals, is ever more cynical about U.S. politics and asking tough questions about the role big money plays in shaping public policy. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Charles Lewis, founder and executive director of the Center for Public Integrity, who discusses this year's presidential campaign and the information found in his new book titled The Buying of the President 2004, who's really bankrolling Bush and his Democratic challengers and what they can expect in return.
We thought that Clinton was a prolific and successful fundraiser, and he was up until his time. But Bush has redefined campaign finance and fundraising and as we know it in the U.S. and actually probably anywhere in the world. This fellow who's been in politics for no more than roughly 10 years, the 94 gubernatorial election through this election, has raised somewhere in the range of $300 million in 10 years. He has raised $131 million just last year, the year before the election, which is almost double his record-shattering 1999 total when he was running for president the first time. Put differently, he's raising $600,000 a day, roughly speaking, and that is an astonishing amount of money. In 1999, Al Gore was raising $84,000 a day to Bush's $230,000 a day. So now Bush is up to $600,000 a day. So it's almost difficult to comprehend these kinds of numbers, but suffice it to say, you don't get that kind of cash from backyard barbecues and bake sales. It's coming from very, very powerful interests that want things from government. And this administration is obviously very, very close to the business community. And, you know, not only has the business community had much of its agenda enacted, but in some cases they have helped to write the laws themselves. There's more CEOs in this administration than anyone, I think, since Calvin Coolidge. And, you know, and it shows in terms of the money. When you have that kind of cash, you have to bundle the contributions together if you're going to get this kind of money. And that the pioneer system where a person raises $100,000, and if they do, they're called a pioneer, and $200,000 now is called a ranger. The sophisticated bundling system has never been seen in American politics to this extent. His closest alliance, obviously, being a former oil man, like his father, is the oil and gas industry. His top patron is Enron, which, you know, the disgraced bankrupt company is still his top career supporter. And there's a very close relationship between Kenneth Lay and George W. Bush going back well into the early 90s and even before George W. Bush officially entered politics. But there are a lot of banks have now circled around Bush in a way that we had not seen in the 2000 book. The Merrill Lynch's, MBNA's, Credit Suisse's, International Bank of Commerce, Payne Webber, Goldman Sachs, those kinds of interests now have kind of entered into his top 10 career patrons. And whether or not it's the dividend capital gain tax cut policies or the offshore banking issue that the banks and Wall Street firms care so deeply about, or privatizing Social Security, or in the case of MBNA, the bankruptcy legislation, these Wall Street firms are all feeling very happy and pretty contented these days with this administration and its policies, and the money flow to Bush and his campaign kind of shows that.
Massachusetts Senator John F. Kerry is most likely going to be the Democrats' nominee to run against Mr. Bush for the White House this November. He's been criticized, of course, by another candidate, Howard Dean, as having taken in the most amount of special interest money in the U.S. Senate. But tell us what you found out in the book, Buying of the President.
Kerry has been around for 20-plus years. He's raised $34 million as a Senate candidate for his three terms in office. He has, you know, altogether raised approximately $66 million, which is about a fifth what George W. Bush has raised, so to put it in perspective. But he is absolutely well acquainted with special interests. There's absolutely no getting around that, despite his comments about showing them the door and all the kinds of rhetoric we've heard in recent weeks. You know, Kerry, by one study, not by our organization, but another one, did take more money from lobbyists, registered lobbyists, than any other member of the U.S. Senate. He's very close to law firms, telecommunication companies, and major banks. So by not going along with the post-Watergate rules, that's why Bush is probably going to raise, well, we don't know how much exactly. It could be $200 million, which is really just astonishing between now and the conventions. And Kerry will not raise anywhere near that, but he may raise 50 to 75 if he's lucky, and he'll probably spend more of his own money. We basically have an out-of-control, pretty wild situation here politically and financially that we have never actually seen in American politics about to play out here.
Key provisions of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance bill were upheld recently by the U.S. Supreme Court. How do you view the soft money ban, its effectiveness, and what further steps do you think we need to take as a country to limit what, you know, some critics say is a prostitution ring up on Capitol Hill?
We interviewed McCain and Feingold and Jimmy Carter and a number of people, Bob Dole, about the state of American politics and the state of democracy today. And the Supreme Court recognizing that money corrupts and that millionaires don't have more free speech than others, those are huge, seminal, tectonic shifts in what people thought the Supreme Court believed as an institution. And folks like McCain feel like they're now in a candy store, that they have any number of potential reforms. They want to reform the Federal Election Commission itself. They want to fix the presidential matching fund system and make it more viable and have more candidates want to participate and, in other words, not drop out of it. You have lots of interesting fermenting going on by the reform community about ways to improve it. At the same time, the folks that fought change and reform, the two political parties and, lots of other folks, are licking their wounds, and they're very, very angry that the court did what it did, and they have every intention of trying to block McCain at every turn. So is it rocket science, and could reform occur if there was a will of the people clearly stated and the politicians felt threatened by the populace on this point? The answer is yes. I think it's pretty obvious that this is straightforward stuff. It's a question of can you do it and do you want to do it as a people?
That was Charles Lewis, founder and executive director of the Center for Public Integrity. Contact the center by calling area code 202-466-1300 or visit their website at www.publicintegrity.org. Lewis's book, The Buying of the President 2004, is published by Perennial. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.